You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Thursday. And we are here, we will be here very shortly with Mr. Or shall I say Deacon Stephen Gradonis.
You should.
I should say that, and I will. And so here we are. How you doing?
I'm good.
Good. How are you? Good. I'm good. This has been an interesting week. We've been tracking similar stories, not especially related to the movies, except, you know, if the movie happens to be something like Gone with the Wind or Song of the South, or Ken Burns' Civil War or something like this. But there's been a couple of stories that have been floating around out in the news that we've both taken an interest in. And so I thought we might spend a little time talking about them today. One is the issue of statues being pulled down.
Yes.
Around the South. And the other is, which we'll also get to, this actually does come a little bit closer to your bailiwick because it has to do with entertainment. The new Bill Nye the Science Guy series on Netflix called Bill Nye Saves the World has been generating a bit of controversy, and I've also been following that story.
Well, you know, I want to say that the first story also is very much in my wheelhouse because it has to do with culture and the significance of art. Yep. And how images relate to ideas and how we perceive the world and how we perceive ourselves as a culture and a society. So, I mean, my interest in movies and my interest in artwork in general, in the artwork of the church, the artwork of the Vatican museums, and all of our other churches, and my interest in the monuments that we raise to our national heroes, all of this is very much of a piece.
Yeah, and it is it's significant. Let's start with the story about the monuments, because I think that it is. It's something that has been bedeviling American discourse, really, really, frankly, for the last 150 years.
Yes.
But it's kind of reached a new new point. So the story is that in a number of places around the South, most notably recently in New Orleans, but there are other places as well.
Many other places.
Yeah, there's been a call for pulling down statues to people like Jefferson Davis or Robert E. Lee or, Pierre Toutant-Gustave Beauregard, who most people don't remember these days, but he's the guy that fired the opening shots at Fort Sumter, that triggered the Civil War. There is literally a monument to white supremacy in a place called Liberty Place or Liberty Circle, I forget, in New Orleans. And the reason that monument is there is to commemorate the great deeds done by people fighting for the idea. This is the inscription on the monument, right? I'm not putting words in anybody's mouth here. The monument is paying tribute to those heroes who stood for white supremacy against, you know, Yankee carpet baggers who were there to screw up our way of life. And so this monument has stood there for the last century or so. And these are getting torn down. And the hue and cry is from people who say things like, this is erasing Southern heritage and culture. And if you do this, then, you know, you're trying to erase the past and et cetera, et cetera.
Which already let it be said that the particular bit of the past represented by that inscription was already erased in the 1990s when that inscription was covered up with a plaque attempting to honor individuals on both sides. But everyone still knew what was underneath the plaque.
Right. Now,
let's also point out historically that this impulse to tear down these monuments is connected with a number of things that are happening in our society. And one of those things, which is also connected with the controversy that has erupted in the last couple of years over the Confederate flag, is the shooting of 9 individuals in Charleston by a white supremacist named Dylann Roof, who announced his intentions of hoping to trigger a race war.
Right.
And this in 2015, this came as a huge shock to many people, especially many white people.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 2 years since then, while we have seen massive repudiation of everything that Dylann Roof stands for and of racism and of white supremacy and of the racist entanglements, not only in Southern culture, but in American culture generally, we have also seen a resurgence and a defense of these things. And many people who previously would have liked to believe that America has gotten past all of that stuff and that this is now comfortably in, you know, consigned to the dustbin of history are recognizing that confronting the issues of race and of unequal treatment that people continue to receive in this country, this is a present challenge, not just, you know, something that Martin Luther King dealt with once and for all and now we're good.
Yeah. And when it comes to, you know, speaking of, you know, art and what art does and what it symbolizes, there's a really powerful scene right at the beginning of a great film called Judgment at Nuremberg.
Yes.
You probably remember the scene. It's right at the beginning. It's the it shows a picture of the swastika adorning, I think it was the Olympic Stadium in Berlin. I could be wrong, but I'm not really sure. It might be a swastika that adorned some, you know, some great public gathering place, perhaps used for the Nuremberg rallies or something. But at any rate, the movie begins with some, you know, Nazi, you know, marching song, and you're hearing this triumphal song, you know, from one of the Nuremberg rallies. And at the climax of the song, the swastika is dynamited and blown to a million pieces. And this happened. This is one of the very deliberate things that was done in a program called denazification that happened throughout Germany after the war. It happened in West Germany, and it happened in East Germany. And this is a very deliberate program by the Allies to smash every symbol of paying tribute to the Reich. And so you didn't find statues left all over Germany, you know, glorifying Hitler, because that's what statues do. That's what a statue is for. It is to glorify and honor somebody. Statues don't exist as painful reminders of the past. Statues exist in order to say this was a good thing worthy of honor.
That's true. And of course, when we look at the statuary and the monuments in the South in relation to the Civil War, we have to remember that the national mood and the intention, certainly on the part of Lincoln after the Civil War, was very, very different from the Allies smashing Nazi Germany.
Right.
The, slavery and white supremacy, let it be said, it was just as virulent and dehumanizing and objectively immoral in institution as the Aryan regime of the Nazis.
Right.
But at the same time, the United States had previously been one nation, and we right. hoped to be one nation again.
Exactly.
And so there were efforts to there was a concerted desire to allow the South to cling to whatever aspects of its culture and its heritage it right. could continue to honor. And right. and so there has been this and even on the part of, you know, of liberal Hollywood, you will see that the culture of the pre-war South and the South in the Civil War is in movies from Buster Keaton's The General to Gone with the Wind. There's something that we celebrate and we romanticize this, and that's
not, oh yeah,
until
the first one of the first truly great films ever made in American history was this massive glorification of the Ku Klux Klan called Birth of the Nation.
Well, yes, that's a, yeah.
and yeah. And that goes to something that I want to discuss when we return. We're just about out of time, but it comes down to this, that the South fought to preserve slavery. The North did not fight to end slavery. It fought to preserve the Union.
Very good point.
Those are two very different approaches to the war, and they resulted in a lot of pain, which we will discuss when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We're talking right now about the push, which I laud, to get rid of monuments to the Confederacy around the South. I have no issue with, you know, museums that preserve, you know, the memorabilia of the Civil War. Of course, you need that. I mean, but public statuary and busts and art whose entire grammar means we are honoring this are, as far as I'm concerned, about nothing other. When we say, as is typically said, that the South fought for states' rights, the right that was being fought for, and in the declarations of secession, we see this stated over and over again in state after state, the right that was being fought for was the right of white human beings to own black ones.
Absolutely true. And even the appeal to states' rights was something of an argument of convenience. I mean, as far as some members of the Confederacy were concerned, they didn't have Northern states claimed too much for states' rights by saying that in their property, on their land, you couldn't come as a Southerner with your slaves onto their property, because according to their states' rights, your slaves would become free if they set foot, for instance, in New York. So they felt that was too much for states' rights.
Yeah. And so, you know, it comes down to this, that the Civil War was fought on the part of the South. The reason for the war was slavery. That's what was being fought for. In the North, the reason for the war, first of all, it was regarded Lincoln in his first inaugural says, you know, in your dissatisfied hands and not my own lies the great issue of civil war. He said to the South, you know, you can have no war without yourselves being the aggressors. And in fact, the South fired the first shots in the Civil War. And so Lincoln makes it extremely clear, and he does this repeatedly, that his he says, my paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union and is not either to save or to destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And yes. If I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. And so he himself confesses that the Emancipation Proclamation was a tactic of war. What he was trying to do was deprive the South of a labor force.
Yes. Now, it should be added first in Lincoln's defense, at least right. I would add. I don't know if you would add. But I would add in Lincoln's defense that Lincoln was not a fan of slavery.
Right.
He did oppose it, but right. he didn't oppose it as a matter of policy, which was right. essential to his presidency. Politically, the possibility of civil war was just unthinkable for him. And so holding the Union together at whatever cost, that was certainly his right. his primary consideration. On the other hand, against Lincoln, I would say that I think that the legality of secession and the argument that the South had the right to secede is at the very least more ambiguous than Lincoln felt that it was. And while it's true that the first shots were literally fired by the South, I think that it's at least highly questionable whether the North really had a casus belli to go to war against the South. That's
yeah,
my feeling.
I think that one can be debated back and forth. So, you know, in sort of in Catholic terms, whether there was a jus ad bellum can be debated, because essentially what the North was fighting for was a constitutional issue. You know, can states just take their ball and go home and leave the Union?
You said something during the break that I'd like you to repeat because it bears on that question. You thread a quote from Ken Burns' The Civil War. I'd like you to repeat it.
Oh, well, yeah. One of the things that Shelby Foote points out in Ken Burns' Civil War series, which is really great, and it's you can watch it for free on, if not Netflix, then on Amazon, and you could probably also find it on PBS for free. Just a fantastic series. And one of the things that Shelby Foote, the great Civil War historian, notes is that before the war, the way the proper grammar was the United States are. After the war, proper grammar was the United States is. And that really summarizes the ultimate effect of the Civil War.
Yes. And even if you haven't seen Ken Burns's The Civil War, that line still might sound familiar to you coming from another great student of American history, Benjamin Franklin Gates, played by Nicolas Cage in National Treasure.
See, you learn so much at the movies.
But the thing that I wanted to say about this is that shift really emphasizes that the Civil War changed the nature of the country. Yeah. That secession became illegal as a policy of war. And there was, I think, because of that, at the very least, a genuine ambiguity regarding the legality of secession and therefore the justice of the North's constitutional right. cause to go to war.
Yeah. I think what the North would argue, and I think is a justifiable argument, is that had the North, you know, said people can just take their ball and go home, and so you know, here's a constitutional crisis, so let's just dissolve the Union. That meant, and I think Lincoln was really acutely alive to this, that meant the death of an experiment in democracy that was simply too costly for him, to bear.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, and having, you know, said, you know, well, they fired first. And so, you know, let's grant jus ad bellum argument that it was a just war from the Northern perspective as a jus ad bellum argument. But I don't think there's any way in hell that you could argue that the North fought justly in a jus in bello, from a jus in bello perspective. The North committed war crimes. There's no other way to put it. Sherman invented, in many ways, and with Lincoln's total approval, invented war, deliberate war on civilians. That's what Sherman's March to the Sea was. It was, you know, Sherman famously said that war is cruelty, and the crueler the better, because then it will be over fast. And so he made war on the civilian population of the South. It's why the South called him the Vandal King.
Right. And people quote his even more famous line, war is hell.
Right.
Without realizing that this isn't just a platitude. That
right.
this is a moral justice, or even it's a you could say it's an amoral justification for right. whatever is necessary. War is hell means there are no rules, and that of course is something that as Catholics we cannot accept.
We cannot accept, and so so all of that granted, you know, the reality is, of course, the war ended. We won. The North won. And then the South, the North had to figure out some way. The whole purpose of the war from the North's perspective was to take an enemy. This would be like the United States conquering Germany and then saying, we are going to, by God, we are going to make Germany the 51st state. You know, and... That's what we were trying to do. That's what the North was trying to do at the end of the Civil War, was tell the entire South, you cannot leave. We are forcing you back into the Union. Well, how do you do that with a population of people who hate your guts?
Yes.
Because you beat them in war. Well, one of the things that you do is, you know, by the end of the war, Lincoln, I think, really has moved from, you know, I don't like slavery, but I'm not going to do anything about it. You know, by the time the war is over, of course, he has not just freed the slaves in the southern states in rebellion, but he has emancipated them everywhere. He's made them citizens, given them the right to vote, and then he dies. And so the North, I think, was really seized with an unfortunately temporary moral fervor about slavery. It was one of the nobler passions of the North, was that it really did take the abolition of slavery seriously by the end of the war.
Yes.
But the thing with moral passions is that moral passions very often fade away. They are, and that's what happens, is, you know, the North occupies the South for a little while, says, you know, we're gonna you know, liberate the slave and incorporate him into our democracy. And then they go, never mind, you're on your own. And that meant, for the next century, Jim Crow,
yes.
lynchings.
Yes.
And a massive system whereby the defeated whites in the South could take out all of their rage on their subject population. And we'll talk about that more when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our guest today is Deacon Stephen Gerdanis, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We've been talking about the controversy about pulling down things like the Confederate flag, for example, last year off of the South Carolina State House. And this year we're talking about, you know, pulling down various statues that... Well, let's not make any bones about it. The purpose of those statues is to glorify people who made war, treasonous war, on the United States in order to preserve the right of black people or white people to own black people. That's what the Civil War was about in the South.
And there is a side of this discussion which debate on this topic, and in particular, the defense of the statuary has typically left out. And I think you want to make a point about this. I want to set it up for you.
Okay.
By pointing out that on my Facebook page, I commented on an article that ran at The Federalist. The Federalist website, and the article is called, the article is titled, New Orleans is Wrong to Remove Its Confederate Monuments. And in the article, the author points out quite accurately that tearing down statues is always about politics and power. And that's true. Now, he doesn't mention that erecting and defending statues is also always about politics and power. And so the question you have to ask is whose politics and whose power? And I just want to point out that in this entire article on the subject of the Civil War and Civil War statuary and what it symbolizes and what it doesn't symbolize, there is a word that does not appear in this article on the Federalist, a word that does not appear in the entire article. And that word, not to put too fine a point on it, is black.
Right.
Now, you actually the word does appear in reference to the bulletproof vests of the men standing at the Battle of Liberty Place when the flatbed trucks arrived to take down the monuments.
Right.
But there's a large group of people with a vested interest in this topic who were just left out of the discussion entirely.
Yes, yes. And that's the interesting thing. Yesterday, Rod Bennett and I were talking about this. We were talking about what sometimes has been referred to as the universe of discourse.
Right.
So when you say everybody loves sushi, for example, what that means is everybody who loves sushi loves sushi.
Right.
And the people who don't love sushi are not counted here.
Right, right.
And so in the same way, one of the curious things that happened in the United States is after you've got, you know, the end of the Civil War and the need to reincorporate the Southern states into the Union and all the rest of it, and there's a really brutal period of Reconstruction. Lincoln probably would have not done this. We're almost certain that Lincoln would not have done this, but Lincoln was killed. And so the sort of revanchist Republicans come into power, and they're just going to punish the South, and they're going to punish the Democrats who were the ones who backed the South in a lot of ways. And so there's this period of brutal punishment of the Southern states with poverty and all the rest of it. And what happens in the Southern states is the humiliated whites who lost the war can't take vengeance on the Yankees, of course. So who do they take vengeance on? Well, they take vengeance on people weaker than themselves. In other words, the freed slave population. And so you get the erection of a whole system of Jim Crow. And with the erection of that system, of course, goes the erection of exactly this kind of statuary. And the purpose of this statuary is to say to that subject population of Helots, know your place. And that's, of course, that's reinforced with things like lynchings and all the rest of it. And that continues for 100 years. Now, while all that's going on, as often happens, the northern states, the victors in the war, start having second thoughts about, was it an unalloyed triumph? of goodness that the North won the war. And Northerners begin to show signs of real guilt about having won the war and having humiliated not the black slave population, who don't count. They don't matter. What matters are the whites in the South. And so by the turn of the century and on into the middle of the 20th century, what you find in pop culture stories about the war is almost always that story is told from a Southern perspective. And it's a perspective of loss and regret and, you know,
which is a really odd thing, because it seems to go counter to the general truism that history is written by the victors. To a very significant extent, the mythology of the Civil War in this country, at least up until the last few decades, has been written from the perspective of the losers.
Yeah. And so, you know, so what do you get? Well, you get The Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith.
Yes.
You know, exalting the glories of the Ku Klux Klan, you know, and the Knights of the South who defend Southern honor.
At that point, the Klan had become defunct, and his film was so influential that it sparked the rebirth of a new and historically distinct Klan. You know?
Yes.
But what you had originally was, I think, more of an aristocratic terror organization, and what you got after Birth of a Nation was more of the yokel hate group that
– Right, yeah. Well, a lot of people don't know that the high watermark of the KKK
yes.
was 1924, not 1870.
Right, right.
1924 was when its biggest enrollment was. Woodrow Wilson thought Birth of a Nation was a fantastic movie.
Yes.
And on and on it goes. So you get Gone with the Wind, the novel, which was a huge success. And it was a tremendous glorification of the South and the terrible loss. You know, what an awful thing to have lost that glorious storybook chapter in our history. And that becomes the film. Of course, the film was the greatest box office of its day. Black characters in the film don't matter, except as accessories to the stories of the whites in the film. But go ahead.
Yes, there is certainly not a story about the injustice of slavery.
No,
you have in the opening titles of the film, it celebrates the Old South as a land of cavaliers, where gallantry took its last bow, the last ever to be seen of knights and their ladies fair, of master and of slave.
Yeah.
So the reality of slavery is put into the context of this romantic medieval view of the South as a culture of chivalry, which in many extents it was. You know, chivalry was certainly part of the mix of the culture in the South and remains so today to a significant degree, much more so than the North. But there's no element of critique here at all.
Right. And the blacks in Gone with the Wind, very clearly the message that's sent is these people are not capable of taking care of themselves. They need masters to, you know, order their lives and all the rest of it.
It's a happy arrangement.
It's a lovely, lovely, wonderful. And this goes on and on, you know, so you can watch right into the early 1960s. One of the Twilight Zone episodes. And believe me, Rod Serling was somebody who was very, very concerned about civil rights in the United States. He wrote a number of episodes that are really angry.
He was politically liberal for.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And yet. One of the stories that is told in the Twilight Zone is it's about this Southerner who is offered this chance by a witch to save the South. And eventually what he concludes is, you know, the cause may be lost. This glorious, noble cause may be lost, but let it at least be buried in hallowed ground. And it's like, what? You know? and so you get all of that going on right into the mid-60s. And the what the civil rights movement did was that it said, you know, there is an entire population of people that aren't getting really mentioned in this beautiful, lovely story of cavaliers and ladies' fair that was lost. And that's really been the fight of the last 50 years. And that's what this argument about these statues is.
Yes, and it continues to be, you know, the defense of the Confederate flag as an emblem of heritage, not hate. You know, what people who say that often, it's literally has never occurred to them that they are expressing what the Confederate flag means to them as white people.
Right.
And the person who says that might live across the street from a black person, and he doesn't ask, what does the flag mean to that person?
Because it doesn't matter. They don't count. There are people who don't like sushi. So we'll be right back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here with Deacon Stephen Gerdanis talking about the Confederacy and disenfranchisement. We'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gerdanis. We have spent the bulk of this hour talking about the phenomenon of statues glorifying people who fought a deadly, traitorous war to preserve the right of white people to own black people. And why that statuary needs to come down, and it needs to come down for the same reason, you know, that we don't need statues of Stalin all over the United States to remind us that Stalin was a bad guy, because what a statue says is Stalin was a great guy. And, you know, we here in Seattle, we actually have a statue of Lenin that somebody thought would be a great idea to buy from the collapsing Soviet Union. And so they did. And now it stands on a corner, street corner here in Seattle. I always spit on it every time I walk past. I hate that statue because Lenin was a butcher who, you know, was the architect of a massive murder machine, the biggest murder machine ever built in the history of the world. And, why should that guy be honored? I think it's ridiculous that Seattle has a statue of Lenin on the corner. It's supposed to be charming and colorful, but all it is a gobbet of spit in the eye of all the victims of the Soviet system. And it should be melted down and turned into something useful, like a toilet.
Well, we don't have a statue of Bill Nye here in the New York area. And if we did, I don't think I would spit on it, but I would probably thumb my nose as I walked past.
Yeah, yeah. And that brings us to the next thing, because we've been talking about disenfranchised people. And Bill Nye's got a new series on Netflix called Bill Nye Saves the World. And he looks at various, you know, issues in science, some of which I have empathy with, you know. So my attitude toward climate change is probably, if you don't know what you're talking about, and, you know, 97% of the experts say X, given a choice between somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about and 97% of the experts, I always go with the experts. I don't know anything about cars, but when my garage mechanic says my car needs to be fixed, I believe him. So that's good, and that's fine. But the problem is that Bill Nye is a science popularizer who increasingly thinks that he is a philosopher or an ethicist or a theologian. And he starts popping off about things that aren't science.
Yes.
And so he yesterday, but in this most recent episode, you know, suggests, and more than suggests, that people who have, quote, extra children, that would be you, for example.
I think that would definitely be me.
And well, me too. You know, anybody with more than two kids, I think it probably fits the bill for extra children for Bill Nye. Well, those people need to be penalized.
Yes, which is hilarious because it comes on the heels of Bill Nye Saves the World segment, in which he expresses profound and deep empathy for other people that he feels are being marginalized and condemned by other people for for the kind of sexual behavior that they want to engage in. He has this excruciatingly condescending and just really, really awful animated segment with different flavors of ice cream. And how, and have you seen this?
You know, the great thing about Netflix is that you don't have to watch it.
Oh, well, it's just, it's so awful that, first of all, the like to unlike ratio of the video on YouTube is astronomically in favor of the unlikes. And you have people who are like atheists and total heathens writing in and almost like falling over themselves to apologize to Christians.
Just he's not with us.
Right. Right. saying things like, well, if this is science, then I need Jesus. really, really awful.
Okay.
And incredibly condescending mockery of the idea that, you know, just any kind of sex that anyone would ever want to have could ever possibly be anything than wonderful, and we should celebrate it all, and everyone should do everything, and it's except too much of the sex that has babies.
That's bad.
Now we're going to punish you for that. Now, in fairness to Bill Nye, we should say that he didn't come right out and say that. He asked the question. He has this panel of people there, and he throws out the question, should we as a society punish people for having these extra children? You had one person who was a pro-abortion and who's was very much in favor of this idea. And then you had another person on, another guest, who threw cold water on the idea and said, this is really an area where we really want to leave it open to people's freedom. And this is a question of human rights and human dignity. And Nye doesn't come out and endorse one or the other of these views, although it seems to me from the line of questioning and commenting that he's at least sympathetic to the idea of sanctions for extra children.
Right. And this goes right back to Francis Galton. Francis Galton was the founder of eugenics. He was a cousin of Charles Darwin, actually. And Galton, he had, I mean, very definite system. And this is the thing, is when you use a word like penalize, what do you mean? Are you saying we'll give a tax break to people with two kids? Well, it could be that.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it can also be China's draconian one-child policy.
Sure.
In which, you know, we will force you to have an abortion if you conceive a second child. That can happen. The idea that can't possibly, it can't happen here, is an amazingly naive take on human history. Of course it can happen here.
Yes, and when it happens in China, you can even have American politicians saying, I'm not going to second-guess the Chinese on this.
Yeah, exactly. You know, well, who am I to say that it's wrong to force somebody? And that's the weird thing. I was talking to people today who were saying, you know, well, limited resources. You know, the Duggars are not our role models. And I'm going, this is what Uncle Screwtape calls, getting the humans to run around with fire extinguishers during a flood and crowding that side of the boat that's already nearly gunwale under.
Yes.
The idea that Americans are in some kind of grave danger of all running off to imitate the Duggar family.
Right.
You know, that's not a problem, right?
No, we are in this country, we are currently at zero population growth. And in most of the Western world, we are experiencing negative population growth.
Right.
The world population is continuing to grow very significantly in Africa and in other places in the developing world. Now, you will get people of this opinion that, you know, we need to manage population in the developed world, who will argue quite cogently that we residents of the Western world are the ones using all the resources and putting out all the carbon, and it's here that concerns for the planet are really focused and not so much in the developing world. But on the other hand, you've got precisely because of all of this population growth in the developing world, there's a lot of movement from the developing world to here. People want to come here and live like us.
Right.
So, you know, it's not as simple as, well, you know, we need to do something about the way that we Western people are. But then, you know, you start wagging your fingers at Africans, and it becomes a lot more obvious and troubling that there really are uglier underlying attitudes in what you're proposing.
Right. It's the policy that PJ O'Rourke described as just enough of me, way too much of you.
Yes.
And that really is that and has been the policy of the first world toward the third world for decades. We are all about telling brown people to just knock it off and not have all those extra children. Well, you know, there are serious problems with that. And not least of them is exactly to what length are you willing to empower the state when you start talking about penalties? And you really can't keep that double think up. You know, you can't at the same time talk about advocating choice while at the same time saying that the state should have the power to punish you if you choose to have, you know, as I've had four children and you've had more. Which of my children do you want me to get rid of? Exactly. And that's really what it comes back to is why is it that somebody like Bill Nye never reckons himself as part of the surplus, as the one too many? Why is it always somebody else that needs to be punished? And that's what's, you know, it's not like we haven't seen a 20th century that was full of colossal murder machines built precisely to get rid of the extras, the people that we don't need. Deacon Stephen Granados, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. We will definitely be having you back on when we switch to the podcast format so we can continue having these great conversations.
All right.
Thanks for doing it. Our producer today was Danny Head. And we'll be back tomorrow with Mr. Doug O'Brien. Until then, have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.